hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program associate here with GTI. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by T.T. Cad and Tim Niven, the Chief Executive Officer and Research Scientist, respectively, at DoubleThink Lab, a really fascinating Taiwanese organization that works to strengthen Taiwan's digital defenses and safeguard its democratic processes. At DoubleThink, T.T. Cad and Tim conduct really groundbreaking and timely research on Chinese information operations, propaganda campaigns, both in Taiwan specifically and around the world. In doing so, they're really two of the people that are on the front lines in confronting China's all-out digital offensive against Taiwan. The recent report, Deafening Whispers, China's Information Operation in Taiwan's 2020 Election, which we'll make sure to link in the description below, outlines the wide array of tools and tactics that China employs in its efforts to undermine Taiwan's democratic systems. T.T. Cad and Tim, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, I'm so glad you could join me at such a clearly crucial time. You know, as your report makes abundantly clear, the threat posed by China's information operations and propaganda campaigns is really a pressing one for Taiwan specifically and for countries around the world. For years, Beijing has been refining and expanding its offensive digital capabilities and has created what is now a massive network of content farms, propaganda outlets, and trolls to push its narratives and undermine counter-narratives. So while nations around the world are targets of these efforts, as you guys make clear in your report, Taiwan really faces the brunt of it. It's really on the front lines. So with all this in mind, I really couldn't think of two better people to have here to share your thoughts and discuss your new report. So I'd like to jump right into it, if that's all right. You know, T.T. Cad, I'd love to start with your recent report, which again is Deafening Whispers, China's Information Operation in Taiwan's 2020 Election. Just to start somewhat broadly, what was it that spurred you to write this report? You know, what is it that, you know, what were the events that led you to write it? And what exactly do you mean by deafening whispers? It's a great name, but I'd love to hear you guys explain it a little bit.
Okay, so this research paper is leading by our chairperson, Dr. Puma Shen, which is a well-known expert on the Chinese information operations in Taiwan. He doing this research with all our different department in DoubleThink Lab, which we also support his research on understanding the different expat and actors or the victim part of these information operations. So by meaning of the deafening whispers, I think that we are observing that those information are not making sounds. They are through online social media in text format or all kinds of these, like a closing messenger app, that you don't see that often on the street. But it has its impact on the word by mouth or in a different group. So I think we are trying to picture it as a very powerful tool and in a new way that using those technology to infiltrate another country's politics.
Sure. I mean, I think that's fascinating and a good name again. As you just said there, I mean, a lot of these tactics that you're tracking are quiet. They go under the radar. And I think DoubleThink Lab does a really great job of drawing attention to them. They're really shedding light on things that may not be in the common knowledge. So for our listeners out there who might be unfamiliar, what are some of the tactics that China employs when it targets Taiwan? You know, what are Beijing's primary goals as it seeks to undermine Taiwan?
Well, obviously the PRC have stated that their goal is to annex Taiwan. So to achieve that goal, some of the objectives that would help to create favorable attitudes towards it being under PRC political control, which would include the strength of the Chinese economy, cultural ties, etc. On the other hand, it's about making the alternative less appealing which is for Taiwan to maintain its sovereignty and its democracy. So the idea would be to make that less appealing. So we see messaging, for example, that democracy is a failure. Democracies can't handle the pandemic, but the authoritarian PRC can. And that, you know, the economy is doing so great in China and everyone's poor in Taiwan. But, you know, if we annex the country, if we take control of the country, then everyone will be rich and happy, of course. In terms of tactics, we've been working on systematically mapping the different actors involved. It's quite a variety of actors involved. So one of the ways that we've broken it down is along two dimensions, a political and an economic dimension. Along that economic dimension, we have capital owners and capital suitors. And on the political dimension, it's, you know, are you more or less politically motivated or economically motivated, really? So, for example, a politically motivated capital owner would be something like the PRC State Media, the United Front Work Department. A capital suitor that's politically motivated might be, for example, a political content farm or a local Taiwan Affairs Office. If you're a more economically motivated capital suitor, it could be like a YouTuber, an influencer, or a commercial content farm. And the people that have capital that be more economically motivated might be, for example, media organizations or criminal gangs. So you can really see there's a very broad variety of kinds of actors that we see involved in PRC information's targeting Taiwan. And we break these down into different modes because we see different originators and amplifiers, different nodes in the spread of disinformation into Taiwan. So it became important for us to look at the modes, the ways that the disinformation is spread. So there's propaganda mode, which is, you know, a central top-down mode. It's usually state media. We have a what we call a little pink mode, online trolls, nationalists. We also have content farm mode, which is quite an interesting one and a dangerous one. So this could be usually companies that are overseas. So in the case of Taiwan, for example, content farms in Malaysia that are not subject to Taiwanese laws about disinformation. And then we also find collaboration mode, which is really about more about united front work and finding local proxies, local trusted personalities in Taiwan that the CCP can put their words in their mouth.
Interesting. I mean, that's fascinating and frightening. I'd like to double back on something you said at the beginning there, where it's kind of this propaganda that's hitting Taiwan from China is kind of has two facets. You know, there's the positive end where it's talking about how well China has handled the pandemic, you know, the benefits of living in China. And then there's the negative side, you know, talking down the failings of the Tsai government on the pandemic. You know, have you found in your experience that one side of this is more common, and do you see one side as more harmful?
I wouldn't say which one is more harmful or which one is more effectiveness, but they do have this different type of this narrative they are consistently used to try to influence our voters or Taiwanese citizens. For example, that the most common narrative they are spreading is that the democracy is a failure. So during the whole 2020 election and also extended to the COVID-19 period, the democracy is a failure that couldn't handle the pandemic and also couldn't help you escalate your level of your life is one of the very common tactics that probably would be surprised to people who are not familiar with Taiwanese politics. There's a narrative that spreading around during our election is that our government, which is the DDP, are a authoritarian government. They are even more authoritarian than China. So some people actually believe that because they think our the Thai government is control every media, and they control those media, and only the good things be reported for them for the election. So yeah,
interesting. Yeah, I think that's an interesting claim by China that Taiwan is the more authoritarian one. But Tim, I'd like to go back to something you said a minute ago, and something that you highlight incredibly well in the report and really thoroughly, is that China makes use of both foreign and domestic proxies in amplifying its message in Taiwan. You know, it's not just coming from China; it's using actors within Taiwan and, you know, like you said, in Malaysia and other countries around the world to really solidify its messaging. Could you elaborate on this a bit? You know, how do they target these groups? How do, you know, whether they're groups in Taiwan, what sorts of incentives do they give them? How do they target?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There is a range of different proxies. So just circling back to the start of your question there, I mean, we know that the CCP, they lack credibility with their state media. And they lack, you know, credibility with their government. Being an authoritarian government, it's not a credible brand. So they need to get around this problem. They need to find trusted locals to put words in their mouths. And this has been observed, you know, in many countries. In fact, some of the things that are more well studied everywhere would be in the domain of the media. Taiwan's quite unusual in that we have one of the four big newspapers. One of the owners is very heavily connected in China in terms of business interests, and he's very unabashed about, you know, spruiking for annexation of Taiwan. That's the Want Media. So that's quite an unusual thing. Certainly for me, coming from Australia and New Zealand, you know, if it was, you know, the Iranian government owning one of the, you know, the big newspapers in the country, it's a very strange thing to imagine. But some of the more unusual cases that people might not have heard about, obviously we have these overseas content farms. So how they make their money, how they're financed, it's quite an interesting thing to look into. I don't think all the details are really well known. There's a great investigative reporter at The Reporter in Taiwan called Jason, who's done some great work on this. I can highly recommend. YouTube influencers are a very interesting case. So we've noticed some things, for example, with YouTubers being approached with offers of money to say, for example, you know, this month you just say a little bit less bad about China, next month a little bit less bad, we'll give you 10,000 US a month, something like that. And then in a few months you say, oh, this China threatening Taiwan thing, that's not really happening. And then we'll give you 50,000 US. So we've had these kind of approaches in our environment. And we also find things where YouTubers will, you know, celebrity YouTubers that don't really talk about politics, all of them will at the same time start saying the same political message. And then, you know, what's the common thread? You know, maybe it's the same management company that they're being managed by.
Interesting. That's an interesting connection. I'd like to build on that a little bit, you know, with YouTube and then onto other social media outlets. I know in the US for the last couple of years, we've been wrestling with how to work with these social media algorithms and these social media outlets to catch fake news, disinformation. But it's clear in Taiwan and around the world that these actors, both in China and elsewhere, can find ways around these algorithms designed to catch fake news. So in your mind, I mean, this may be an impossible question, but how can algorithms be improved to more effectively spot disinformation campaigns?
I think that there's a lot of ongoing development of those technology solutions that we have been heard. When more research for information operation on those platforms come up, more indicators, more evidence, or more behavioral pattern, could be identified by the social media companies, so they can build more like indicators to red flag those like suspicious activities. So from my knowledge is that both Twitter and Facebook did it. Some of them they are publicly sharing, and some they are still keeping it in a circle because, you know, it's kind of like a racy game that once your adversaries knows how you identify them, they will evolve their technique. or the way they use. But the problem is, I think that when we think about those like algorithm solution, we needed to also realize that the machine is not perfect. So those machine learning is built on the data we put in. If those data has the bias, they could probably has the potential to hurt the freedom of expression by wrong flagging the real users. And usually those users are who people has the different political views with us, and also they are also very vulnerable for like conspiracy theories or other propaganda information.
Well, yeah, on that point, I could add that in terms of algorithms, we also have the ways that the algorithms are currently facilitating the spread of disinformation. So insofar as, it's been studied by many people that algorithms often tend to promote content that's sensational, that gets an emotional reaction, that's likely to drive engagement, which is obviously facilitating it. So the social media platforms, they're not content creators, but they are content curators. And so people like Joan Donovan, who are world leading at studying that, really should be listened to on these issues, I think. But something that Facebook Taiwan did, which was really good, during the 2020 election in Taiwan, they started to put these content farms, the problematic content farms that we identified, they ranked them very lowly. They started to rank them low. But the problem with this solution is it's a little bit whack-a-mole, because once they realize this, they just change to a different domain and you have to find it again.
Sure. That makes it... It's clearly a difficult thing. I mean, it's clearly, just like you said, it's a whack-a-mole strategy, but it's fascinating. I'll be interested to see what goes on in the next couple of years. But I think you guys have done a great job of discussing what China's doing. I'd like to turn now to what Taiwan's doing in its efforts to combat these Chinese tactics and these information operations. So while Taiwan clearly receives more frequent and intense disinformation attacks than really any other state, it's also proven to be among the most resilient and successful in combating them. So, TTCAD, in your experience, how has Taiwan managed this? Are Taiwan's efforts primarily led by the government, or are they more of a whole of society approach?
I think it's more whole of a society approach that government also, the government lead activities is more like they are creating this like cross agency tech force, and those tech force will identify those like trendy or about to trend disinformation that relate to major political issues, that is disinformation or fake news. They will try to debunk as quick as they could. But the whole society approach is that we see the vibrant of the Taiwanese civil society, just like what we've been seeing in 2014 during the Sunflower Movement. So Taiwan civil society has this like awareness and being very strongly after the 2018 Han Kuo-yu's election. So after he got elected, for the Kaohsiung city mayor, the first trip he took is to go to the Hong Kong and meet with the CCP officials. So I think that it's a wake up call for a lot of people, and there's more evidence shows that there's unusual amount of the internet activities to support Han during his local city mayor election. After he got elected, more evidence shows that. So I think the people are building up this like a stronger safeguard of the democracy movement, mostly online, but also people are there's a group, young people, they go to the like a hiking site or like a community place to try to reach out to elder people they couldn't reach out from on the internet, and to try to raise their media literacy. So those kind of efforts from online on the offline, and try to raise more awareness on the Chinese information warfare is happening. I think that's why we have this successful resistance has built.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'd like to follow up on that real quick. You know, you mentioned that there are these groups that are trying to educate people in digital literacy, and, you know, reach people that might be more susceptible to disinformation. You know, in your mind, have these tactics been successful? You know, how successful have they been?
Yeah, so just give one two example. One, the volunteer group I just mentioned, they go offline. What they call is fake news cleansers. So they are volunteer-based community. They are at the very first, they only have two or four people. But in the end, they have hundreds of the volunteer. They are working at different places in Taiwan. They've been invited to community, university, or other different places to try to tell people that not everything you see online is true. So they are trying to educate citizens for the digital literacy or media literacy, how you do the simple fact check by yourself. And last year alone, they have more than 300 speeches in 1 year, and it is all done by this. They don't have any full-time staff until this year, so I think that's amazing. And also, it really shows that how people really need to understand those things. Another example is a online chat bot, which we have Colfax, and another one is MyGoPen. And the MyGoPen started with not only the chat bot, but they also do like a real person line app. Line is like a WhatsApp, but there is a WhatsApp, Taiwanese, sorry, Asia version of the WhatsApp here. So it's a messenger app. So 90%, more than 90% of people in Taiwan are using Line, as well as in Japan and Thailand. So at the very first, they have this like a real person account, which means like you can add them like you added your friend, and they are real person. So you can send a message to them and they will do the fact check for you. So you send a message you got to them and ask them whether or not it's a fake news, and then they will do fact check for you, respond it by manually, which is impossible, which is, you know, when we first heard this idea, we think how you can do that, right? And how you can scale up. You never think they can scale up, but they only have like two or three people. And in the end, almost like 2 years, they've been responding all these messages from strangers while they have a dinner, while they have a on the toilet or whatever activities they do. But in the end, right now, they have more than 400,000 people subscribe to their account. So, yeah. So those two examples, I love those two examples, is because they are doing the stuff not only leveraging technology, but that they also do by their hand and they try to reach out to people from the human aspects. Yeah.
Interesting. Again, looking at this from the United States side, what's so impressive about Taiwan is the ability to do this sort of fact checking and to do this sort of counter disinformation thing without it succumbing to polarization or over politicization. You know, how is it that this fact checking and, you know, counter disinformation work has remained not as politicized in Taiwan? You know, how has the Taiwan government and these organizations managed to maintain public trust when it's such a contentious thing?
My feeling is that the reliance on and trust in civil society is quite important. It's something that Audrey Tang talks about a lot. She really likes to stress this point that, it's almost like a responsibility thing, I guess. If you put trust in people and you give them respect, then they act responsibly. If you treat them like children, then, you know, maybe they act like children. Maybe it's a bit like that. In terms of general politicization, I'm going to throw that to TTCAP, but I did hear an amusing anecdote from somebody who runs one of the fact-checking organizations. There was a police officer in Taiwan who mentioned to a KMT politician that something he said had been fact-checked by this organization. And then the next day, that politician held a press conference claiming that this proved that that fact-checking organization was working for the DPP.
Yes. I think that's general problem and challenge for most fact-checking initiatives. Not only here, but also in other places. So I think it's inevitable that those fact-checking initiatives will be labeled as belong to the fiction of your adversary. Even there's a CCP government, they are also running the fact check on Weibo, try to promote their alternative fact. So it's not, so what I'm saying is that I don't think that the polarization here is also very strong and also very high. I think what makes it different is that we do have a real threat coming outside of Taiwan, and they are getting stronger and stronger. Their attention, ambitions are more, it's not that subtle, even though they are they have more advanced tactics, but they are very openly to threats Taiwan's sovereignty most like every day. So I think those moves are actually decreasing those propaganda effectiveness here to Taiwanese people.
Interesting. To take a step back real quick, you know, and focus a little bit outside of Taiwan, as you make really clear in your report, while China's information campaigns are strongest and most intense in targeting Taiwan, they're not limited to Taiwan. These are tactics that are used around the world. And given Taiwan's really long and thorough experience dealing with China's different disinformation campaigns and propaganda, are there lessons that the Taipei could impart to other countries, particularly, you know, the U.S. and the West? And, you know, what tools that we might have mentioned earlier have proven to be most effective?
Well, definitely Taiwan is on the front line. And many people consider that what happens in Taiwan is a precursor to what could happen in other countries later. So obviously, in this respect, we can help the world by analyzing the strategies and tactics and how they evolve in Taiwan, in order to give a warning to the rest of the world and what they might be able to expect. And in terms of responses, I still think that a reliance on and trust in civil society, I think many people would agree that letting the government make decisions on truth and falsity can be a slippery slope and a dangerous thing, and certainly not, maybe not a good strategy, particularly in a polarized society.
Yeah. I think Tim's right. Add on that, I would say that the most dangerous things we see from our report, the four different modes that we have been discussed, the most easily to find is the propaganda mode and the pink mode, because it's very easy to see. You saw those like a CCP state-funded media, they publish those propaganda every day, and there's a lot of a little pink or online trolls will targeting all kind of things on Twitter or on other platforms. But we think here from our study, the most dangerous one is actually the content from mode or the collaboration mode, especially for the collaboration mode. It means like people who took the money or took the directions, and they build the content, they make the content, and then they distribute the content. They are all from local your local society, which they are all Taiwanese. So it's very hard for us by using any open source intelligence technique to find out whether or not this person or those group of people are actually getting the money or direction, unless there's something like unless there's a leak or there's regulation tools that we can our government agency can start an investigation. So I think that kind of activities, which is collaborate with the local people or like a marketing firm or PR firm, this tactics is not only being seen in Taiwan, because it's that because that tactics is very closely related to the whole United Front work that the China government is operating in all kind of countries in the world. So I think that's the most important lesson that we think what happened in Taiwan we should show to other countries, especially for their civil society to understand there's a threat is coming.
Sure. Well, thank you both again for sharing so much on what is clearly a really pressing issue. And I thank you both too for your work at DoubleThink for really shedding light on what is a heretofore not covered enough issue. So I'm so glad to talk to you about it. And based on this conversation, it's clear that these operations, these information operations, constitute a major threat to democracy around the world, not just in Taiwan. And with that in mind, I'm so glad to have you both here to share your insights. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns, especially Margot Garcia at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.